The local Cambridge paper prints that salacious article in the headlines that there was a group of neo-Nazis meeting in Westminster College. Is there someone here who could kind of defend our cause and say that was not what was going on?
Would anyone object to us circulating your email address to the group? No. People have asked that. We can do it if you give us permission.
We have a morning together, but I just wanted to say thank you for the privilege of being here. It struck me last night, not everyone was there, but a number of us were together in the pub. And I looked around and I thought, this is an odd collection of people.
Thank you for that. We love you.
Peculiar people, indeed, exactly. And it's, that's what I meant, that we are.
Dig,
that's right. But there's no way we on our own could have put together something like this, because we tend to stick with like, don't we? But it was the diversity. I thought the places we come from, our backgrounds, just so diverse, and yet in just a short period of time, the Lord has really built us together as community, and it does for me feel like a slice of home, a slice of Labrie. It's open, learning from each other. I'm just thrilled. It's nice to see that it can happen. Lots of places. Well done, Christian Heritage. I think the format. Yeah. Thank you for that. But yeah, I think we've all contributed. I told Sid and Jenny last night that often when I go away, I come through the door and Helen says, why didn't they, the people who worked me, why didn't they just send you back in a body bag? Because that's about what you're good for at the moment. Whereas I feel refreshed after this week. I think I'm going back better than I came, so thank you. That's true for you, true, that's right. In light of what's happened so far this morning, as Wendy sat beside me at breakfast and said, I have a question about how we view Muslims today. And then Joe, his devotional is very much about migrants, student workers, refugees. For us who are Europeans, as I know it's an issue in Australia, Wendy says a growing migrant population in her town. I hope nobody minds. I'd like to do the Why God is Hidden lecture first, and for the second, our last session together, just open it up for a discussion about, we can start with Muslims, but to take up the theme we've already been introduced to this morning, because I think it's key for apologetics, absolutely key, and we haven't touched it this week. Martin, is that okay if we break the schedule? It will just be, I don't have a lecture, we'll just have an open session. I think we have to engage so deeply in the subject now. So that's where we'll go for the rest of the morning. Okay, so this lecture is really dealing with the question, why God hides, or the hiddenness of God, which I think is a critical question that I often hear in my work at Labrie. People who say, why should I believe in a God who I see no evidence for whatsoever? So I think it's a key apologetic question, and I want to address it in this lecture. Some of you may know this story. In the first half of the 20th century, the world's most famous atheist was Bertrand Russell. And being in Cambridge, it's good to mention the great Bertrand's name. He was an amazing man. He was the equivalent to Richard Dawkins of our own day. And when Bertrand Russell was dying, a very close friend came to visit him. And the friend said to Bertrand, you are the world's most famous atheist, and here you are, you're about to die. What if you were wrong? What would you say to God if you actually met him? Your atheism was flawed. What would you say? You die and you meet God. What would you say to him? And Russell replies, I think I should say to him, sir, It appears my atheistic hypothesis was erroneous. That's an understatement. Would you mind answering me one wee little question? Why didn't you give more evidence? Why didn't you give more evidence? I use that anecdote because I think the vast majority of those who live within a modernist secular framework see no evidence at all for the reality of God. And I think as apologists, we must never forget that this is the basic starting point for those who are not Christians. They begin from a foundation that God is hidden. There's no evidence for him at all. And this acts just to reinforce their belief. And I think as apologists to the modern condition, we have to take this starting point seriously. A pre-modern person wouldn't have seen it this way. It's a modern condition. They would have seen lots of evidences. God wasn't hidden for them. For us, he's hidden. So we have to take this starting point seriously, and I think there are two main approaches in apologetics that deal with this question. God is unseen. He's hidden. There's no evidence. The first apologetic approach is to give evidence that points to the existence of God. So we could use arguments from natural theology, arguments that break down a scientific materialistic worldview to show that God's not hidden. And these are approaches that bring the Creator out of hiding. And this approach has been well worked by apologists down through the ages. And I think it functions as an effective tool with dealing with the fundamental question of the apparent hiddenness of God. The second approach, I think, is taken very rarely, and it's the one I want to focus on. The second approach is to affirm, as the Bible does, that God is indeed hidden. And there is very compelling reasons for his being hidden. So, someone says, I don't see God. We can launch in and say, but here's the reasons why God exists. We'll try to bring him out of hiding. Or, and this is the one I increasingly use, yep, you're right, God's hidden. I agree. And here's why. And that's the one I want to deal with this morning. Now, the question of God's hiddenness can be asked in two ways. The first is, why does God hide? Which implies something deliberate in God's part. It's something he does. God hides himself. The second is, why is God hidden? Which implies that the reason for hiddenness lies with us. It's our problem. And I want to ask those two questions in that order. So firstly, why does God hide? And the answer to this question, I believe, is that he can do no other in order to be true to himself. God must be hidden in order to be true to who he is. And that for me is an apologetic answer that we can give to people. So we dive in, usually say, no, but he's not hidden. Here are the reasons. But I'm saying, no, he has to be hidden in order to be true to himself. Now to unpack this, we need to do a little bit of theology. And that's what I want to do now. Firstly, I want to look at the structure of reality. So what is the totality of reality under a Christian worldview? And I think it's on your handouts, but two categories, as I said the other day, creator, creation. The creation breaks down into two parts, seen, unseen. Then there's a line here, an absolute line, and the creator is the uncreated. That's the basic structure of reality according to the Bible. Creation has a seen part, science can deal with that part, that's phenomena, but there's an unseen realm of reality, which is part of creation. Angels, and under the fall, demons, the supernatural realm, that all belongs to creation. But then on the other side of this absolute boundary of being, we have the uncreated, the one who is the creator of the whole thing. And what this diagram reflects is that the creator and the creation belong to different orders of reality. And these two orders must never be reduced to each other. That's where we start in terms of uncovering why God is hidden. The second thing we add to this is the idea of holiness. It's the holiness of the Creator that secures the distinction between the order of the creation and the order of the Creator. So take the line from that great hymn, which is one of my favorite, "Holy, holy, holy, Lord God Almighty." And in the third verse, it says, "There is none beside thee." There is none beside God. As the Creator, God is totally unique. There's actually nothing we can compare God to. He's in a category of his own. And the word holiness, which is often used to describe God in the Bible, means otherness. He belongs to another realm of being. So there's a fundamental difference between the Creator and the creation. That means you cannot fit the Creator into any of the categories of creation. He is other. Martin Buber, we looked at him the other day in my lecture on what is relationship. He said, God is the eternal you, who in his very nature cannot be made into an it. He cannot be reduced to categories of creation. That's what it is. Categories of creation. The eternal you cannot be reduced to any of the categories of creation. So that means there's no reference point for the Creator in the creation. And when you make a reference point for God within creation, you commit idolatry. That's what idolatry is. You find a representation for the unrepresentable. And that's why the Bible teaches that there is no image, no symbol, no representation for God that adequately reflects him in creation. The two exceptions to this are we as humans, who are the image of God. Remarkable. We represent God, but we're the only representation of God in creation. And then the other is Christ. Hebrews 1 said he's the exact representation of the being of Creator. But apart from that, all we have in creation are analogies of God. And analogies acknowledge dissimilarity while trying to connect things together. So we have lots of analogies of God, but they're not representations. And all this means that God the Creator cannot be made normal according to the categories of creation. I think the modern church is guilty here of trying to make the Creator normal. Put God in the pocket and we can pet him. And you can't. This is fundamental to the Bible's doctrine of God. There's a distinction between the two. He is holy. So the idea of holiness. So there's a boundary of being between God the Creator and the being of the creature. And that boundary is why God hides. This is the point. It's the boundary of creation, creator, that hides God. He is holy. He is other. He doesn't exist in the order of creation. So we shouldn't expect to see him or find him in the same way creation functions. You see the point? If God is holy, why should we expect to find him in the order of this? He's holy. He's other. So, we begin with the structure of reality, which is this, and then we emphasize that the Creator is holy. He belongs to another order, being. And then I want to add the third point, which is the idea of glory. Now, in the Bible, the idea of God's glory, the Creator's glory, is related to a status as the Creator, that he belongs to another order of being. And the word glory reflects the weightiness of God. In Exodus 33, verse 19, Moses asks the Creator and says, "Show me your glory. I want to see your true self," which is, "Would you please come out of hiding?" Now the question we need to ask as we wrestle with that text is, did Moses see God? Did he see the Creator? And I think the answer is no. Hamish isn't sure. Yes, there. Yeah. Yeah. But in terms of Moses' encounter there, it's interesting, the detail. The Lord, first of all, says to Moses, "It's impossible to see my face and live. You can't see God and be and survive it." That's what he says first. Then, what does he do? He hides Moses in the cleft of a rock. He puts him in the back of the cave where it's darkest. And then one more detail, he covers his face. That's a double covering. Put him in the back of the cave and then boom, cover his face. And then, even with all that, he only got a glimpse of God from the backside as he was disappearing into the distance. It's not very much, is it? And yet, look at the impact on Moses. He glowed. Incredible. That's the glory of God. It changed the appearance of Moses. Just the palest reflection of the Lord's true being as creator. And this incident, amongst many others in the Bible, reminds us that the creature cannot bear the weightiness of the Creator's glory. And that's why he hides. At one level, we should be glad he hides. We can't bear it. Paul in 1 Timothy chapter 6, 15b and 16, addresses God as the blessed, the only ruler, the King of kings and Lord of lords, who alone is immortal, who alone is creator, that's what he's saying, and who lives in unapproachable light, whom no one has seen or can see. It's pretty clear, isn't it? God is hidden. Unapproachable light, no one has seen or can see. So here the glory of God in Paul's doxology poem is associated with light. However, the glory is so brilliant that he's rendered invisible by it. And that's actually why through the ages of the church, glory has often been symbolically associated with darkness. The glory of God is so brilliant, it's actually darkness. It's invisibility. You can't see it. And that's actually also reflected in the Great Holiness Hymn. Though the darkness hide thee, the hymn writer says, and goes on, though the eye of sinful man thy glory may not see. And it's actually true of unsinful man also. We can't possibly see the glory of the Creator. So the point is that the glory of God, his beingness, the weightiness of his being, hides him from our view. And this is actually where many of the mystics got it right. The Spanish mystic St. John of the Cross actually does state something very true in his famous book, The Dark Night of the Soul. And part of the thesis is that to experience hiddenness, to enter the dark night, is to touch the reality of the Creator. There's real truth in that. It's a biblical truth that John of the Cross is putting his finger on. So all this reflects that the reality of hiddenness is tied to the very nature of the Godhead. So let me put it to you like this. If God did not conceal himself, he would not truly reveal himself. So God hides, and in this, he reveals who he is. He is the Creator. He is the Creator who does not belong to the order of creation. He is holy, he is other, he is glory. And that's an answer. Now, people might not like that answer, but that's the truth of how it is. If we stand in this creator-creation distinction, going back to the worldview, the three, monism, dualism, and Trinitarianism, Trinitarianism starts with the distinction between creation and creator. It's fundamental to our doctrine of God. Now, we might not like this idea that God is hidden, but I would say idolaters always rail against it. Idolatry is all about reducing this creator above this line of being, boundary of being, and reducing him to the creation. That's idolatry. Reduce the creator to creation, and then he becomes seen, manageable, controlled. But God never allows himself to be reduced. He hides to be true to himself. And we as creatures might not like that reality. We're actually addicted to reducing the Creator to the order of creation to try and make him normal, but he cannot be made normal because of who he is. Right, now thus far in our little exercise in theology, we've been reflecting on what we might call the transcendence of the Creator. Transcendence is he's beyond, beside, but in another realm of being. The Bible, of course, also reflects God as being immanent to his creation. So we reflect the side where he's hidden because of who he is. That's transcendence, but he's also present to his creation. And because he's present, there's revelation of himself in creation. So Psalm 19, the heavens, the sky, declares the glory of God. His glory, glory of creatorhood, is reflected in creation. He's left his fingerprints, if you like. So because he's immanent, there's self-disclosure. He leaves evidence of himself on his creation as his artwork. So within creation, in creation itself, we see the evidence. And we can see creation, as we said several times this week, as the artwork of God. This is the artist, this is his artwork. The thing about artists and artwork is they're not the same in essence. So this isn't just a pure extension of himself. It's a reflection, but not an extension. Then, of course, in the Bible, we see an even greater disclosure within the creation. The Bible is God's speech act to the worlds. Now, I use the word speech act because creation is not the speech act of God. Speech act is when the sign giver uses signs, and you can't separate the sign from the sign giver. It's much more extension. Whereas I don't think creation is an extension of God. Speech is. And it's interesting that the translation, the proper translation for Psalm 19 is very clear. The NIV really got it wrong here. It says, the heavens have no speech. There are no words. It's not a speech act. Yet their voice goes out. But the point is that the heavens don't function like speech. Yet the voice goes out. It still says something, like a piece of art does. But the Bible, a speech act, is different. Because you cannot separate God from his words, like we can't separate ourselves from our words. That's speech act theory. So the Bible is an increasing disclosure. And then, of course, in Jesus, we have the perfect representation of God. And that's because Christ belongs to the order of the Creator. And when he is reflected in creation as a person, it's a perfect reflection. So you see increasing streams of revelation. Creation, there's a reflection. The Bible, it's an extension of God in terms of speech act. It's incredible. And then in Jesus, it's fully a representation of the hidden God. So increasing streams. And when Jesus comes, God is fully out of hiding. The Creator is out of hiding. And so theology, good Christian theology, biblical theology, stresses both the transcendence of the Creator and his immanence, and how this immanence works. And that means that the Creator is both hidden and revealed. And both take place simultaneously. God hides, and the reason he hides, he can do no other to be true to himself in terms of his creator status. But he also reveals because he wants to be in relation with his creatures. He hides, he reveals. And this two-sided aspect of how God deals with us, he hides, he reveals, is actually reflected perfectly in Jesus. Jesus is the perfect representation of God. And one of the enigmas of the Gospels, as you read them, is that Jesus says, I am God, here's proof, yesterday John 5, I am God, and here's the proof of it, and shh, don't tell anyone. You see that through the Gospels? He reveals, and he says, shh. He hides, he withdraws. That's a theme right through the Gospel narratives. So he didn't come as a celebrity saying, look at me, that's what celebrities do. Out of hiding, take lots of pictures. No, his words and his works revealed, and yet he also hides. And this reflects the essence of God the Creator, because Jesus is God. He makes himself known and he hides. Now I want to try and give an analogy here that reflects this a little bit. And I'm probably committing idolatry. We're talking about one of the great mysteries of God's relations with creation now. He hides, he reveals. But the closest I could get to try and understanding the relationship between hiddenness and revelation and how they function was by venturing into the world of humor. I become interested in what we could call the comic moment. The comic moment is the moment of humor and what happens in that moment. It's a little bit of what I talked about with the aesthetic capacity. We live most of the time in what we could call ordinary perception. Ordinary perception means that we live with just one level of meaning, and there's so much about reality which is hidden from us. We live in ordinary perception. Now, the comic moment actually just draws the curtain back so that ordinary perception disappears for a moment and we enter a hidden sector of reality, something which normally we can't see. And that's what comedians do. Comedians take the most ordinary occurrences. They're brilliant at it, the best comedians. And they parody. This is someone talking in a mobile phone, and they talk to you about what you're doing when you're on a mobile phone. And you think, wow, I never saw that before. It becomes revealed, and you laugh at it because it's so outrageous to see the deeper meanings of it. That's the comic moment. When someone tells a good joke, the curtains come aside and you see a deeper sector of reality. You see its deeper meanings. And that's the wonder of comedy, of humor. That's why the prophets use it all the time to destroy our idolatries, to say, this is what's going on. So the comic moment appears within the everyday, within the ordinary. It makes its revelation, then it disappears. And it reminds us that things are not as they seem. That's what comedy is. Things are not what you think they are. And I think it's like this with the Creator. He hides, and in this concealing, he reveals something about himself. Never forget that. That's ordinary experience. We can't see God because he belongs to another realm of being. But there are moments, like the comic moment, when he comes out of hiding, he reveals, and he reminds us that things are not like they seem. Just because I'm hidden doesn't mean that I'm not totally imminent in creation and working in it. But when the curtain is drawn, like the comic moment, it's an exceptional moment rather than a normative experience. So when we reflect on the nature of God's relationship to creation, it's essential that we maintain, firstly, that he hides alongside he reveals. And we're going to pick up on this point again as we move to my second point, which asks the second question, why is God hidden? The first question is, why God hides? And the answer is, he hides to be true to himself. And in concealing himself, he reveals who he really is. But now I ask, why is God hidden? And the answer to this question lies with us. God is hidden because of a problem in the human creature. Here we're focusing on the problem of our response to God and how our inadequate response leaves him hidden from us. And this is also an apologetic argument. It's not a comfortable one, but it's an apologetic argument. Now, in order to get into this, I want to ask the question, what does it mean to have a personal relationship with this God, with this Creator? It's a phrase commonly used by Christians. I have a personal relationship with God. And I think it's a very confusing, potentially misleading idea. I believe in personal relationship with God, but I think the way we use the term can be very misleading, to the point where sometimes I wonder if we should even use it anymore. And it's so commonly used by us. I think when our theology is done properly, we see that the difference between the nature of the Creator and the nature of the creature sets the parameter for how the relationship must function. And I say that because there's a certain order to relationships. And the order of relationships is determined by our position and our station within that relationship. So I see three basic orders of relationships that all humans stand in. First of all, there's the order of relationship of human creature to the creation. Psalm 8 says that the Creator has crowned us as humans with glory and honor and put everything under our feet. So in this relationship, our station as human persons puts us over the rest of creation. We have dominion over it. Not domination, dominion. And that means creation bows to us and it bends to our formative power. That's the first order of relationship. Human creature to creation, we're over it. Creation bows to us. It's incredible, but that's the station God has given us. The second order of relationship is human creature to human creature. And here there's mutuality. We share the same station. So we bow and we bend to each other. We mutually submit. We mutually serve. Because we're equals within creation and called to serve and love each other. So that makes us face to face. Creation bows to us. Second one, creature to creature, we bow to each other. The third order of relationship is the creature to the creator. And in this relationship, the order changes again. Because we are the creature, we bend to him. And our place, our station, is to respond to him. That's the third order. Larry Crabb put it like this. The gospel involves the God who has made himself compassionately immanent as an expression of and with no violation to his weighty transcendence. He does satisfy our hunger. But even as he does, his glory, his status remains the point. We bend to him. It's never the other way around. This is where we most go wrong. We forget that. His glory remains the point. We bend to him. It's never the other way around. Now, one of the implications of that third order is that we as humans, as creatures, have to meet God the Creator on his terms. It's coherent to this order of relation. We have to meet him on his preferred terms. So we have to respond to how he has chosen to reveal himself to us as our creator. The point is, he sets the terms for relationship, not us. Let me read a quote here by a theologian who reflected this well, contemporary theologian Paul Moser. He said, "Who is entitled to decide how one may know God? Humans or God?" Who's entitled to decide that? How one may know God? Humans or God? Given our inferiority to God, can we reasonably make demands on God in favor of our preferred terms of knowing him? Many people proceed as if we have a right to know God in our preferred terms. This is, however, nothing more than a self-serving assumption. Nothing requires that God supply knowledge of God in our preferred terms. God evidently owes no such thing at all, despite our common expectation to the contrary. That really sums it up. He sets the terms. And that is why the Creator's way of imparting knowledge of himself is not normal to us. Within creation, our terms of knowledge, in terms of epistemology, is different within creation of how and from how we're going to know the Creator. So within creation, science legitimizes that we stand over creation. Now it should be dominion, not domination. And that in this relationship of creation bows to us, we set up knowledge in our terms. So science is about bringing control to creation through abstractions. Abstractions are ways of putting categories on the world in order to control it and understand it. So we're going to create species over here, this species and that species. That's fine. As creatures who have dominion over creation, that's what we can do. But it's impossible to unveil the Creator in that kind of way. There, the terms are different. We have to know him on his terms. So we're simply saying that the Creator can never be domesticated to our ways of knowing. It's impossible because of who he is. This is the order of relationship here. So we either accept him on his terms or he remains hidden. And that's why God is hidden to so many people. They just refuse to accept him on his preferred terms. He remains hidden because we try to reduce him to the order of creation. to science. We're never going to find them in that way. That's what domestication is all about. Now let me briefly highlight here some of the ways that humans attempt to domesticate the creator, try making him bend to us, back to the first order of relationship. We do this, first of all, by trying to turn God into an experience. I call this the making of the celebrity God. So the creator is there to excite us, to thrill us. And if we have some experience of him, and that's what we can do with creation, we can manipulate creation to give us experiences and to touch our feeling. If we try to do that with God, he will remain hidden. And I hear lots of people at Labrie say, I will believe in God if I have this kind of experience. He does this, this, and this for me. And I increasingly say, those are just you setting the terms for how you're going to know God. It's not going to happen. Saying that, God is very gracious and sometimes does accommodate to that demand, but it's not normative. And if he does it once, he won't do it second, third, fourth, fifth time, because then he's just becoming domesticated. So I think one of the ways we act, try to bring the Creator into the first order of relationship, something bending to us, is the experience thing. If he does this, then I'll believe in him. The second way we do it is by trying to turn him into an idea. This is what I call the making of the philosopher's God. If I can figure God out intellectually, if I can make sense of him, then I'll believe. Now, just like with science, philosophy is the same way. Creation, reality, is under us, and we try to make it bend to our will and to our intellects. If we treat God that way, we'll never find him. You see, it's about making the Creator bend to us. We meet him on our terms, or he meets us on our terms, rather than the opposite way. And God won't work like that. Which is why there are no proofs for the existence of God in the Bible. And I don't think the lack of proof for the existence of God is because God couldn't do it. I imagine there probably is some kind of proof for the existence of God, but he refused to give it to us because we'd mishandle and misuse it. It would change the terms in which we come to him. And the fact is, God is not an abstraction. You can abstract anything in creation, but you can't abstract God. And if we try to reduce the Creator to an idea, an abstraction that we have control over, he will remain hidden. Which is why we cannot remove God's hiding with our intellectual games. I see this at Labrie. The more people try to make God bend to their brains, the more confused they become. Because the order of relationship is being violated. We'll go here again in a moment. The third is to turn him into an instrument. Turn him into an experience, to an idea, or to an instrument. I call this the making of the economic God. And it's very easy for people, including Christians, to turn our belief system into instrumental religion. So God becomes a tool by which we control our worlds. God is one of many tools. So the great thing about our dominion of creation is that we use formative power, but steward tools in certain ways in order to bring dominion to the world. Now, if we employ God, the Creator, as just one of those, we violated the order of relationship. And we can do that. We say, I'm going to use God, and he's going to make me healthier and wealthier. The health-wealth gospel is the greatest heresy spawned on the church in the last 100 years. It's pure poison. Having traveled a lot in Africa and South America, you see it's evil, and it's used for very evil ends. It actually gets right to the heart of paganism. Paganism is trying to bring the gods from the unseen realm into your power in order to give you an advantage over creation, to make you more fertile, more virile, better warrior, wealthier, and so forth. Dominate nature. And the Creator, we often demand that the Creator become instrumental for us there, but he won't. I say this hopefully gently, but many prayers to me, the prayers of many Christians, sound more pagan at times than they do Christian. It's about power rather than a relationship of love. Bowing and submitting to Him. Coming to Him as our Father, we can bring all of our requests to Him. But when it goes to come some kind of a power thing, God, come down and give me power as a Christian over my enemies and over this and over that, we can quickly slide into paganism. We've reversed the order of relationship. So these are some of the ways that we try and bend the Creator to our will in order to make Him come out of hiding. If God makes me wealthy, look, He exists. Now, it's not that God doesn't bless us. And in our submission to Him in the third order, we bow and bend to Him, that the blessings don't reveal themselves. Labrie is all about trying to be a demonstration of the reality of God. But the order isn't violated. It's not, if you do this, then this. It's coming as humble creatures, saying, these are our needs, and the blessings flow. So the key to finding God is that as human creatures, we bend our wills to Him and meet Him on His terms. And that's the proper response that leads to God coming out of hiding. So I believe as a person bends his or her will to the Creator and meets the Creator on His terms and not our own, then we find that the Creator is revealed. There's enough light, there's enough revelation to respond to. I really believe that. That every human person, every creature, if we respond to Him in His terms, we will find Him. Now, that's a matter of the heart, isn't it? Responding to God in His terms is the idolatry we're wired against. But if we do, we'll find Him. And what I love about it is I think He gives exactly the right amount of light. Blaise Pascal is brilliant on this in the Ponzes. He says, if God gave less light, the true seekers wouldn't find Him. They'd remain in the dark. There's just a little bit less. And that would mean their will would be frustrated. They're trying to meet Him in His terms, but there's not enough light. But if God gave too much light, those who were indifferent would find Him against their will. And they'd be coerced into acknowledging Him. So in terms of the order of relationship, it's just the perfect amount of light. If we bow to Him, there's enough. He's out of hiding. But for those who are in the other order, he will remain hidden. That's the point. So in this way, He respects and fulfills the will of all. He acknowledges the will. He reveals and He conceals. We're back to that point. And again, you see this in Jesus. He performs one miracle and there's double responses. Those who were seeking after God on the right order of relationship see Jesus for who He is, and they become one of the 500. Those who were hostile and in the other order of relationship, they're blinded. For all the evidence, they couldn't see it. That's the point. Some saw, some didn't. Jesus told a parable. For some, oh, now I get it. Others, blinded. You see the point? Just enough light. One act, diverse effects. It all depended on whether you were trying to bend God to your will or whether you had bent your will to God and were meeting Him on His terms. Whether you were trying to reduce the Creator to the creation or as a creature you were bowing before the Creator. This can never be violated. That's the point. Now, because God gives exactly the right amount of light, it must be true that the real seeker will always find Him if they meet Him on His terms. And I believe that. The true seeker who meets God on His terms, doesn't violate this, will always find Him. And that's what the Bible says. The familiar verse, we one of a number, Jeremiah 29, verse 13. You will seek me and find me, how? When you seek me with all your heart. Back to the heart. You will seek and find me when you seek me with all your heart. If you're a true seeker, I will not be hidden. That's the promise. I will not be the hidden God if you're the true seeker. Now, how does this work? Because for so many, this is an empty promise. People come to Labrie, non-Christians, are angry. I've been seeking God so hard, and he's still hidden. Well, I think this verse simply reflects that we have to be prepared to meet God in his terms. And the term is that we're pursuing him with our whole heart. The reason of the heart is bowing in the proper relationship before the Creator. If we seek him on his terms, we will find him. Now, what I want to do to illustrate this, just as I close, is to show that how this verse eliminates both rationalists and cynics. The rationalist will never, ever find God, nor will the cynic, because they're not seeking with their whole heart. And the rationalist can look like the true seeker, but actually that's their problem, and here's why. The rationalist has the expectation for God to be as clear as day. They're interested in the God of the philosophers. That is, they're interested in the reduction of the Creator to an idea that they can control and figure out. That's their terms. See? He bends to us. I figured God out. That's what rationalists do. I've controlled him. I've just got it all figured. The cynic has an expectation for God not to be there. Europe is full of cynics, isn't it? So a cynic starts with a commitment not to be committed. So in a sense, they don't really want, though they're searching, where their starting point is I will not commit to anything. And they begin from a posture of defense. They can look like serious seekers, but they just want confirmation of their doubts to hold them in the place where they don't have to commit to anything. Those are the two categories that I often see at Labrie. You love them, but I see rationalists, I'm just going to figure this God out and then I'll believe, and cynics who just want to confirm their doubts. They're often very, very bright, but they just keep asking their questions to solidify their doubts so they don't have to commit. They both look like true seekers, but I don't think they are. So the rationalist seeks God by reason alone, the reason of the mind, but the problem, they're not seeking him with their heart. The reason of the heart is not engaged. Therefore, according to Jeremiah, the Jeremiah verse I just read, they're not true seekers, because a true seeker has to seek God also with the heart, not just with the mind. The cynic, despite appearances, is not really seeking at all. They're simply looking for confirmation of what they think is already true, that God doesn't exist. Again, it's not true seeking. So neither the rationalist nor the cynic is really seeking God, and that's why neither find him. That's why he remains hidden. Now, you can't do this in one sitting with a rationalist or a cynic. You have to get to know them well, very well. But over time at Labrie, this is what you begin to show. It's impossible. Your terms will never allow you to find God. The terms are wrong. They're not God's terms. The Bible teaches that only those who seek with the whole heart find. That eliminates the rationalist. And it also teaches that all who seek find, which eliminates a cynic who isn't really seeking. That's the point. So this illustrates that the problem of God's being hidden lies not with him, but with the nature of the seeking. Right. Well, let's leave that there. I mean, a lot of people say that's not a real apologetic argument, but I think in a relational term, it's one of the critical ones that we found at Labrie. Because, as I said, most of the people, I think, fit into those categories. Today, rationalists or cynics, and I think we have to show them where the problem is with the seeking. And then the first part of it, rather than always going for natural theology arguments, but look at the evidence for God here and here and here, there's legitimacy to that. I increasingly say, yep, you're right, God's hidden. There's common ground immediately, but here's why. He has to be hidden because of the nature of reality, to remain true to himself. Safe travels, Noel. Great to be with you.
Bye, everybody. Bye.
Well, let's open it up, Fiona.
So the kind of the prayer and the attitude of the true seeker, that would be a sort of humble kind of, you know,
humility would be humility and gratitude. For a person to move into being a true seeker, those two things, humility reflecting that they are the creature who live in dependence on an ultimate reality which is not the creation. Really acknowledgement of that. And then if you're beginning to live like the creature, you have to live in some kind of gratitude. What I find at Le Brie is when people can begin to say thank you for things, and if you know you're loving them, you're providing them with hospitality, I think someone is almost doomed when they start to be thankful for something. Gratitude is a very significant step towards the Creator. But then suddenly, boom, they're in a different place and they're beginning to become the true seeker. Yeah. Which is why, you know, I think today if we're dealing with rationalists and cynics, if we don't have a context that goes beyond a purely intellectual argument, we often just spiral right into the heart of the problem. So I'll listen to all the intellectual questions, deal with them for a while, then I think, uh-oh, I'm not going to engage this anymore, purely intellectually, because this is the problem. They just want to, on his terms. Yeah. Well, it's just the idea that glory is a symbol of light, isn't it? The angels appeared in their glory. But the glory of God is invisible. Light reveals things. So this is more in the mystical traditions, but it's in the Bible itself. You know, God is hidden on top of Mount Sinai in all of his glory. Hiddenness implies darkness, doesn't it? Something is in the dark. So, I mean, for poets, this is an artist, this is lots of material, isn't Rose? How do you bring light and darkness together? That you're playing with these metaphors, which I think really do reflect the reality of who God is. He's ultimate light in his glory, and yet we can't see it. So it's hidden. It's darkness. It's on the other side of the absolute boundary of being. We see reflections of God's glory in creation, but his real glory is something else.
Is it not adequate to simply say we see God in Jesus? we see him fully there. But I guess that's just a different question, isn't it? That's not the answer people are really looking for.
No, but it's the truth. As I said, in the terms of the streams of how the Creator makes himself imminent to creation, the completeness of his revelation is Jesus. Because the absolute boundary of being, which we're a little bit afraid of today as Christians. Some people have used the absolute boundary to become mystical in an unhelpful way. But it's to say the Creator and the creation belong to two different orders completely. But then that raises the problem, well, how does the Creator and the creation connect? Which is the human dilemma, isn't it? How do we connect? And that connection is ultimately in Jesus, who perfectly connects it to. He's fully this and fully creation, divinity and humanity, connected. So the incarnation makes all the sense in the world to me, even though I can't give you a mathematical formula to hold it together. It's a powerful apologetic argument in a worldview level. But yeah, people, it's not going to satisfy many people. He lived 2,000 years ago. He died 2,000 years ago. I want something more up to date. Part of the modern problem is we're so ahistorical. If it's not present and immediate, then it's not real. So that's one of the dilemmas. But I agree with you. Jesus is the answer. The Sunday school answer to every question. It's true. You guys probably heard this 100 times. Teacher held up a picture and said, "Now, children, I want you to tell me what this is." And there was no answers at all. Everybody was looking a bit uncomfortable. And teacher's getting a little bit upset. Sunday school teacher, "Come on, tell me what this picture is. I know you know." And the most precocious boy in the class, even he looked nervous, and he put up his hands. He said, "Well, I know it's Jesus, but it sure does look like a squirrel." Being that all the answers in Sunday school class were Jesus, but yeah. But Jesus really is the answer.
Could you explain what you meant by the word that doesn't be a reveal creator or reveal creator, isn't you mentioned something which I didn't understand about it.
About word?
Word, yes.
And I mentioned briefly speech act?
Yes.
Well, speech act is I as a person with the capacity for the symbolical, I use words. And my words are an extension of my person. So you cannot separate out words from a person. One of the problems in the modern context is we have all these words in the internet and we actually dissociate words from persons, but actually they're not. So this is a theory that linguists have been working with the last 20, 30 years, which is speech act theory. So you cannot separate them. So in the Bible, it's critical to revelation. So one of our problems with revelation, we've lost speech act theory. To engage with God's words is to engage with God. Yeah, so there it is. God created the world by his word, by the word of his power. But that doesn't mean creation itself is language like this. So that's why I gave the true interpretation of Psalm 19. They have no voice, they have no speech, yet their word, there's a communication there, goes out into all the world. So what I think the Bible reflects is creation as a reflection. So a piece of art, you look at it, and it reflects something of the artist, but it's not an extension of. Whereas our speech acts are more in the realm of extension and not just reflection. So this is hard for us as moderns because we've devalued words. It's one of our great challenges in terms of using the Bible. But if we can recover the Hebrew conception of what word is, and then Jesus is the Word. In the beginning was the Word. The Word became flesh. The Word is an extension of God because he is God. And actually, Jesus as Word is just a much fuller representation. So creation as a revelation and the Bible as a revelation are two quite different types of revelation. Creation is wonderful as a reflection, but the Bible is so much more immediate as words which are connected extensions of the word giver. I think our doctrine of the Bible has to reflect that. Does that answer it? It's why the Bible talked about to not take the words of God seriously was not to take God seriously. It's a problem. We don't want to categorize people, but do you think generally today we're dealing with rationalists and cynics? Do you guys recognize those categories?
Well, I've got a friend who presents the same emphasis that you've described as a cynic, but he would claim to be a Christian.
Hmm.
And that's what was in my mind, because he's always asking questions.
Yep.
And always is my very deep questions.
Yep.
Usually related to suffering, related to death of a Christian friend. But he's doing it for about 20 years.
Yep.
In fact, he didn't go to Bible college to try and find out the answers.
Right.
But he never seems to get to an answer that he's satisfied with.
Right.
And it's a constant sort of nightmare for his Christian friends.
Oh, I can imagine.
But I don't know whether that's the same. But it's, you know, but there's something in that which is, maybe he is very bright, and maybe he can't accept answers which don't fit his preconception. I don't know.
And I have a lot of sympathy for Christians who are fed up with easy answers. EA, I call it. Suffering that just doesn't satisfy me. I make a distinction between cynics and skeptics. I mean, I don't know, but it sounds to me your friend, though still in turmoil, is still open. If you go and do a theological degree, you really believe there might be an answer. A skeptic operates in a closed circle, and it's tight at every point of the circle, and that means they're not really open, and they're fundamentalist. So there's no opening anywhere for something to come in and challenge that circle. And usually a good cynic is intellectually very robust. And they can just bring back one more question, which you have to answer. And a clever one you can never compete with. A skeptic, so that's a cynic, that's what I mean. All they're doing is looking for confirmation of their doubts. And they're committed to not committing. A skeptic, for me, is open. And I would say if he's functioning or she is functioning well, it's kind of a spiral. And there's some questions where we might not ever get to the complete answer, but you believe there is truth and you're moving towards it. And I would say healthy skepticism is so important. You would never ask a question if you weren't a healthy skeptic. The church needs to be full of many more healthy skeptics who are asking loads of questions, even difficult ones, but they really believe that there is an answer. We might not get it completely. A church full of cynics would be a terrifying place.
But does the skeptic commit? Obviously the provisional commitment to things, even if there's questions and answers.
Yeah.
But this bloke, because of this, never commits. He claims to be a Christian, he commits in that sense.
Yeah.
He doesn't commit to the church.
Yeah.
He doesn't commit either because he's got so many issues he's got to work out.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
Maybe he is a cynic. It's a hard one.
Can a skeptic commit even if there's still good issues in skepticism?
No, my view of cynicism is that the cynic finds it the safest place in the world to never commit to anything. They're terrified of actually making a commitment. So I call it a Nietzschean spiral. They just keep going round and round, but they're never going to stand on anything and then take a step. It looks courageous. These guys look like courageous questioners. They're not. We have to love them, be compassionate. This is simple. I'm wired for this. If I wasn't a Christian, I'd be a hardcore cynic. It's the safest place. I don't have to commit. And you can make everybody else look stupid. Cynics make me look stupid.
Can't commit to there being no God.
What's that?
I can't commit to there being no God.
No, there's some that's kind of an inconsistency in some ways, isn't it?
No, that's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Commit to there being no God. Yep, yep. And so, yeah.
Understand your question. Can a skeptic?
Yeah.
Sorry, did you ask that question?
I think a skeptic, first of all, Socrates was someone who championed a healthy skepticism, and he says that no question could ever be thoroughly understood.
Yeah.
We can't mine anything exhaustively, and if we just keep going, we're going to get somewhere. Now, I think that Christianity is better than that, but at least Socrates says, in order to be a healthy skeptic and ask questions, you have to commit to there's a truth. So you're committing to the possibility of an answer. The cynic isn't committing to the possibility of an answer. That's how I've done it. Is that clarified a little bit? I want loads of skeptics in the church. I love meeting non-Christians who are skeptics. This is poison. Yeah. I mean, and we can fall into skeptics in some, into cynics in some areas. There are Christians who are cynical about anything in the public place. Politics,
yeah.
Bankers, they're cynics. There's no possibility of them, they're being a good politician. It's a terrible thing to do.
They never see the donut. They only see the hole.
That's right, yeah. Yeah. That's right.
I'm always struck that Jesus after I think I've got this right. Jesus after his resurrection. I mean, the disclosure of his resurrection was only to those who believed.
Yeah.
And he could have walked into the temple before giving Caiaphas and asked that. But he didn't.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I've never thought about that. It was very selective, wasn't it?
He was selective.
Yeah.
But to those who already believed, who already followed it.
Yeah, that's right.
They didn't believe in the resurrection, so they didn't believe.
Yeah. And I love what he does for Thomas. I mean, this is evidential apologetics, just for Thomas, because Thomas is so hardcore in his doubt, and yet he wasn't a cynic. And so, Thomas, look. Wow. Oh, that's beautiful. There's some people for whom you give a lot of evidence.
I mean, we I think we do encounter cynics, whether we meet more cynics or encounter more cynics than rationalists. I'm not sure. It depends what circles you live in.
Yeah.
But I wonder also whether a cynic, if you, it's what I call, this is a dust and sandals job.
Right.
You know, forget it, move on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
some people who simply, they do not, they have set up barriers to that you just are using up time and energy.
Yeah.
I'm not sure whether that's approach to that,
yeah. I guess I want to give a fair bit of time in a relationship before I make the judgment cynic or skeptic. Because
yeah.
If you called a skeptic a cynic, I kind of wrote them off because they're in the closed circle. That would be a terrible thing. But I'm kind of with you. When I feel someone is a cynic and we're just going around the circle together, and actually they confuse me after a while. They say they're cleverer than we are in that they can ask questions which they keep doing it. And wow. But at that point, I refuse to engage them round their circle, but you can still love them. Yeah. And I mean, we're all different, but I think if our neighbor or our brother-in-law is a cynic, you know, we're stuck with them. So we might go round the circle, but actually, there are some things that I think pierce the heart of cynic. I think love can wear them down. And I said the other day, people can be cynical about all the ideas in Labrie. You guys are just so shallow and narrow-minded. But I've never met one cynic. We have a lot of really hardcore cynics come to Labrie. Hardcore. I've never heard one person reflect a cynicism about our hospitality. Not a single person in 16 years who said, yeah, and the meals you serve, you guys are just trying to win me over. You're just trying to manipulate me. And Andrew, when you asked me how I was this morning, yeah, you didn't care. I've never heard, because within a context of a home, it's very hard to be cynical. There's a few things left in life that we can't be cynical about. And I think real hospitality is one. So I think there are ways we can still deal with cynics. But yeah, I'm with you. We just say this is actually unhelpful to go around this circle. Or with a rationalist. Nope. Someone who says, I have to have all the answers before I believe. I usually, my final thing with them before we start talking about Pink Floyd or something is, because many say I have to exhaust all the other possibilities intellectually. So I need to, before I come back to Christianity, I need to look at Islam, Buddhism. And I say, well, if you're going to do that exhaustively, I hope you're going to live a very, very long life. Because I've been a Christian for 20-odd years, and I'm just scratching the surface of the very faith system that I'm committed to. It's so much bigger. In fact, I'm not going to exhaust my own faith system in 100 lifetimes. So if you have to exhaust Islam, don't read the Christian books on it. You've got to read the Islamic scholars themselves. But the problem is, there are so many divisions within Islam. So I just want you to know, you need to look at the Shiite and the Sufis, and there's lots of little subsects there too. It's important to understand all of those, and actually you probably need to go live with them for 10, 20, 30 years if you're really going to understand them. You know, just showing that the idea that we have epistemological certainty when we've exhausted something is nonsense. It's like I said yesterday with a scientist. I'll go back and do all the experiments again, and then I'll continue my research. It's impossible. You have to have a faith commitment to a body of knowledge. You have to find a starting place, which you say, this is reasonable. So the way I do it is, if someone says, there's a lot about Christianity I cannot figure out, but I know this much, I look at what they say they know, and I say, well, let's make that your starting point. Commit to this starting point and step on it and say, and then explore the rest from within the system. Because the cynic never takes that step. But if someone can say, I say, is it reasonable that the personal God exists? Well, step there. And then from within the system, explore it. And some people, my colleagues, aren't sure about this. I tell them that if you find, having made the commitment to a foundation, that it's not satisfactory, step out of it. I think it's fair to say that you can then step back out. But at one level, when I read a text by a Buddhist, I think to take it seriously, I have to suspend disbelief to engage their idea. So I don't become a Buddhist from my heart. But in the reason of my mind, if you're really going to engage the Buddhist literature, step into it and engage it. That's how you learn something. If you're always like this with something, you don't quite engage it. Does that make sense, Doug? Yeah. Yeah, that's right, absolutely.
That openness.
Yep.
I can never get to know you unless I love you.
Absolutely. Or you're interested in a million things, Jan, but in cycling, if you only read cycling magazines and never got on a bike and did it, it would be a little shallow, wouldn't it? Yeah. To love a bike is to buy one and get on it.
Mm. So I guess that the brew for the apathetic.
Yep.
It's love. Hospitality
really
start. I mean, I'm just wondering about that, because we're talking about thinkers here.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of people that are just not thinking, and are apathetic.
No, I agree. Although I don't know, you guys can help me. I'm sure there's other categories. I think cynics, the best cynics, are actually quite apathetic, but they're smart enough to kind of keep from a commitment by just putting another argument out there. So I think there are apathetic cynics. Because that's why I called it. It looks courageous, but it's the safe option. You can never be disappointed if you don't commit to anything. And I actually think the roots of a cynic are psychological. I mean, you just told a bit of the story of your friend Jeffrey, but you said that one of his friends died.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, at that point, you don't become a psychologist. But when I really see what's driving something, then I think, well, if we keep talking about the problem of suffering theoretically, I don't know if that's the problem. Is you just are broken inside because of this loss and. Absolutely. Absolutely. So, K-E-Y-E-S.
Beyond cynicism.
It's one of the most helpful cultural critiques I've read. What I love about Dick, my oldest son at university became a cynic, and Dick's book saved him. But one of the things that Dick said so helpfully is that we mustn't throw out suspicion with cynicism. So we're not, to dismantle cynicism doesn't mean we shouldn't be suspicious. Suspicion is a very good thing, which means critical faculties are really important. Whereas Nathan got this idea from the church that actually you shouldn't be suspicious. To be a Christian and to be suspicious is wrong, but Jesus doesn't say that at all. He calls for all kinds of discernments and judgments about things. Suspicion is good. 3 cheers for a good suspicion.
You've not been a Christian very long. Have you told us how you became a Christian?
How did I become a Christian? Yes, it's mine is a very non-Labrie kind of story. I wasn't working through loads of the arguments. I was brought up in a Christian family. My dad was a pastor. I was a very archetypal pastor's kid. Went crazy for a while. Never really completely rejected the intellectual side. My problem was I kind of think I knew it was kind of true. But I didn't like its restrictions. What brought me to Christ was my grandfather was dying. We're an English family. Went to Canada, then came back. And my grandfather was a very simple man, uneducated. Taught himself to read, actually by reading the Bible. And he was dying. And so I spent some time with him as he died. And I was flirting with all kinds of philosophies, existentialism mainly, which is about death. It's saying, how do we make any meaning of life in the face of death? And here's my dear grandfather, who I loved a bit, this simple man who was looking death in the face with this courage that just blew my mind. Basically, that was it. The integrity of this man's life in the face of death made me think, this is for real. And at that point, I just kind of gave in. Why rebel against something that has the power to face death? So it was really, you know, the example of a life. My family background, a wonderful family, but they were hardcore pietists. The chariots of fire and nothing else. I mentioned that the other day. And, although they did have my parents had culture in the house. They read us lots of great books, and we did listen to good music. But it was very that was part of my problem, and not a lot of Christian thought, if I can put it like that. The kind of church where you left checked in your brain at the door when you went into the church, and then picked it up on the way out. And the context I was converted into in terms of a church was exactly the same. We follow our what we grew up with. And what it gave me is a tremendous theology.